You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Time now to have a look across the world. And Ruth Gledhill, religion correspondent for The Times of London, joins us. Ruth, welcome back to Sunday night.
Thank you.
Ruth, we were discussing earlier in the program attitudes of young people today with regard to the church. We did refer to the World Youth Day event here in Australia, and the fact that even though you get great aggregations of kids coming along to things like that, there is still a very difficult generational disconnect when it comes to religion. But of course, the next World Youth Day is coming not too far away in Spain.
It's just coming up, and they reckon that 2.5 million people are going to go. It's going to be in Madrid. There's hundreds of people going from the UK, and there's a lot of excitement among young Catholics in Britain because many of them were involved in organising the papal visit here last year, and they're getting a kind of double bite of the cherry, if you like, because they're going off now to World Youth Day where the Pope will be there doing a vigil, and they'll be there for that. And so for many of them, they might get another chance actually to meet him. So I think there is a palpable air of excitement here, but you're quite right. There is also concern throughout the church about the fall off in allegiance by young people, and this is nowhere more apparent, of course, than in Ireland, but there is a disaffection among the young, which isn't unique to the Catholic Church. It goes right across the whole of the Christian tradition. What's interesting at the moment about the Catholic Church in Britain is the revival of a more conservative Catholicism. And this is proving to be of great appeal to young Catholics who are maybe growing up in an uncertain world and facing a future where the world seems in so many respects to be in meltdown to their youthful eyes. And what the church offers is a kind of haven of certainty and of old-fashioned, strict moral values. And they are turning to that with pretty much admirable fervour. So it's the opposite to what it was in my day, my generation, when we all, or they all, rebelled against the conservatism, the 1950s conservatism of their parents. These young Catholics are rebelling against the liberalism of their parents, and we're getting a new generation, and that's going to be very interesting. I hope I'm still alive to see it.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see whether it's sustained or it's a short-term phenomenon.
It is, because the church is suffering many attacks on its credibility, both from the exegesis side and exegetical side, and from the practice of the religion by a minority of priests who have really abused the name of the church as well as children.
Well, it's one of the things that's, I guess, fueling this disquiet on both sides, and we should go now directly, I think, to that issue of the Cloyne report in Ireland and the traumatic impact of that. You have a young people, as you mentioned, the conservative swing, who are saying, look, that liberalism brought us all this looseness in morality. We need to get back to coherent morality. And there are others saying, no, it was that very conservative strictness which led to the hypocrisies revealed by the Cloyne report.
I guess so, and there have been some senior clerics actually blaming the 60s for the climate where the kind of paedophilia scandals we're seeing were able to take place. But in fact, the paedophilia went back way before that and isn't unique to a particular climate of liberalism or conservatism, as we all know. In Ireland, of course, we've just had another report. This one was in the South, in the Republic, and it's the Cloyne report into child abuse in the Diocese of Cloyne, which was headed by John McGee. And he has lost his governance of the see over this issue. What is remarkable about this report is that it seems to have been a proverbial straw that's broken the camel's back. And the Irish Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, Enda Kenny, really stunned the church and the world by launching an unprecedented attack on the Vatican especially. And this was because he claims that, and the Cloyne report claims, that there was an attempt by the Vatican to frustrate an inquiry in Ireland as recently as 3 years ago into child abuse. I'll read you his words. He said, the Cloyne report excavates the dysfunction, disconnection, elitism and the narcissism that dominate the culture of the Vatican to this day. The rape and torture of children were downplayed or managed to uphold instead the primacy of the institution, its power, standing and reputation.
What's interesting is he says that in the context of saying still that he regards himself as a Catholic.
Exactly, and you're seeing this very remarkable change in the culture of Ireland, where it's never been a confessional state, but obviously the religion, the Catholicism, was so intertwined with Irish identity. It's really part of it. It's so fundamental to the national identity. And what we're seeing here is a process now where this is gradually being disconnected. That link is slowly changing or being disconnected. And the people of Ireland, I think, are not losing their faith. But from what I hear is, and from when I visited there last year, from what I saw, is that they are taking it more internal to themselves, into their homes, and it's almost becoming a private religion. And many are still going to Mass, but they've kind of lost their trust, I think.
It's a sort of repeat, in a way, of the other great sexuality issue of the 1970s. That was birth control, where a number of people said, well, look, the church can maintain its teaching, I'm still going to engage in birth control, and walked away from an acceptance of moral dictate. And this seems to be exponentially larger, but the same sort of phenomena.
Well, that's a really very good parallel. And what's interesting about this one is that Dublin Archbishop Dermot Martin actually agreed with Kenny. He was impressed by the emotion. Well, I'm not sure he agreed with every part of it, but he certainly was impressed by the speech. And you do have almost the Vatican at war with its own church here. The Vatican has withdrawn its ambassador, and there is talk that the Irish government might close the mission to the Holy See, or sell the building, rather, and merge the mission with the secular mission. You know, it's really an extraordinary outworking of ecclesiastical and secular politics going on as a fallout of this whole. But, of course, this story has been going on for years and years and years, and it's really remarkable in a way that this falling out hasn't happened before. In Ireland, conservative Catholic friends of mine over there look with longing at England and Wales, where we had this crisis back in the 1990s, culminating in a report by the Lord Nolan's Commission, and that put in place safeguarding procedures, as a result of which the church is seen to have put its house in order. Now, only a few days ago, we got the latest figures for child abuse, and they had been an increase in reporting of historic cases, and mostly historic, but a few current cases as well, of allegations of abuse. And the safeguarding commission said the Pope's visit last year gave people the confidence to come forward. And so the Catholic Church in England and Wales, and in Scotland too, is seen to have grasped this nettle, you know, and to be living with the anger and somehow managing it.
So the rise in reporting is actually seen as a positive thing because people are no longer afraid or no longer prepared to keep it hidden.
Absolutely, and that's remarkable, isn't it? What it shows to me is the creditable and fantastic change in culture that has taken place in the Catholic Church in England and Wales.
Keeping on cultural issues for the moment, let's shift to the Anglican establishment and its relationship with the broader culture, but also, more importantly, what's happening with the divisive and fractious debates that have gone on in Anglicanism, and particularly the Catholic overture to the Anglican Communion to create an ordinariate where Anglicans are invited to come across with open arms.
A positive way of looking at the creation of the ordinariate is it is a possible bridge to future unity. However, the waters have been slightly muddied by a recent controversy where there was an Anglican charity. Well, whether it was truly an Anglican charity is currently under dispute. But anyway, it's a 150-year-old charity that many of its members would have regarded as Anglican. Until a lot of them, people in positions of responsibility in the charity, including some of the trustees, converted to Catholicism into the ordinariate, at which point this charity then gave more than half its assets, £1 million, to the ordinariate.
Oh, now you're speaking about things that really matter.
Yes, and it's called the Confraternity of the Blessed Sacrament, and it was founded in 1862, and definitely it was founded as part of the High Church revival in the Church of England. Anyway, this given over half its assets to the ordinariate. You know, the head of the charity was himself a convert priest and is now in the ordinariate. And the head of one of the wards, a priest called Father Paul Williamson, an Anglican priest who hasn't converted but is from the Catholic tradition in the Anglican Church, has made a formal complaint to the Charity Commission, who are now investigating this. But I understand that even some very senior people in the Church of England have written letters, and the Pope has been written to, and the Archdiocese of Westminster has been written to, and there is a huge row simmering under the surface here, which is going to explode in due course when all the legal processes have been gone through with I think, some pretty spectacular flames.
Surely the churches, both the Catholic and Anglican churches, would be wanting to see this issue settled without resort to law. I mean, it's not in either of their interests to be seen to be flailing about in the courts over such filthy lucre.
No, absolutely not. But I think that the root and grass level, there is such a high degree of anger about what's happened on the one part by those left behind, if you like, and there's such a high degree of justification, you know, that this was legal and we were entitled to do this by the others, those who gave the money, and that I think that I can't see any other way, really, that it's going to be resolved. And technically, it is a legal matter. It's not something that can be talked about in a vestry and resolved with a few blessings here and there, because it does involve constitutions and changes to constitutions, and it transfers a huge sum of money.
We're running out of time, but we shouldn't let this moment pass without speaking of the death of one of the great figures of English Christianity, certainly in the post-war world, and that's John Stott, known for many years around the world as the rector at All Souls in Langham Place in London, but more spectacularly because of his writing and the influence he had on the evangelical side of Anglicanism and indeed evangelicalism throughout the world.
He was seminal, and he really inspired the present conservative evangelical revival that's taking place in the Church of England, that has done so much, according to its critics, to divide the church over the issue of homosexuality, but according to its proponents, has done so much to bring the church back to biblical orthodoxy. And really, John was the instigator of this movement, and it, as a figure of the 20th century in particular, he is really on a level with Billy Graham and people of that stature. His influence on the Protestant tradition just cannot be overstated. It's almost difficult to believe he's not there anymore.
When we're talking about evangelicalism, I think probably the interesting thing to mark about John Stott is the difference in the tenor of evangelicalism preached by Stott and that which you get associated with evangelicalism in the United States. In the United States, it's associated with finger-wagging moralising, the Pat Robertson variety. In the UK, you've got the Stott evangelicalism still linked to that old social justice tradition of Wilberforce.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Stott's evangelicalism was like that, but Wilberforce and the Clapham sect were very much an action-based movement, and they were very active in foreign mission societies and very active in the slavery debate and very active in politics and parliament. What John Stott did was slightly different in a way. He really focused on the biblical orthodoxy side. If you look at some of the things he said, it's very much about the authenticity of the Bible and of the words of Jesus and of the message of the cross. Our Christian conviction is that the Bible has both authority and relevance, and that was the message he constantly hammered home time and time again in all his sermons, in all his books. And if anything, I would say to the church away from politics. I mean, he didn't take it away from social justice. That was a part of his platform, but he saw the way to social justice as through the mechanism of the Bible, through the instrument of the Bible. If anyone wants to understand what's happening at the moment in the Anglican Communion and this, you know, this massive disconnect between the liberal side of the church and the evangelical side, they only have to look and read about John Stott, and it's all there, really.
Because there are those on the conservative side who would like to own John Stott's mantle, who I think he didn't share altogether their convictions. There's a sort of very hard Calvinist edge to some of this that wasn't quite totally Stott.
Well, you're probably referring to your own Archbishop Jensen.
Well, that's for you to say, Ruth.
In Sydney, but he has taken Stott's evangelicalism really to its logical conclusion in many respects, and because it's a mistake to think that Stott wasn't uncompromising. He was pretty uncompromising in his message. If you read it, it was a message preached with love, but there wasn't much wriggle room there. And all Peter Jensen has done is kind of implemented, if you like, the way Stott preached it and the way Jensen preaches it and the way other people of that kind of evangelicalism preach it. It does carry a lot of power, and it can't be dismissed as something that is not credible or not relevant today. If you go to churches like St. Helen's Bishopsgate in the City of London, for example, which is, I suppose, one of the main inheritors of this tradition, it's a strong, uncompromising gospel message. But the people in that church are top city financiers, they're top doctors, they're people of high intellectual caliber. And they're people often who are very wealthy, and a lot of money comes into the church through this particular form of conservative evangelicalism. And whereas, you know, the liberal churches, they will say are often declining and often less wealthy.
Yes, you're so also seeing it people like Nicky Gumbel too and his work in...
Nicky Gumbel is from a slightly different evangelical tradition, and Stott, in a way, was the founding father of both traditions, and two slightly different movements come out of it. And Nicky Gumbel is more on the charismatic side. I say that with some caution, because it wouldn't be go as far as the Vineyard churches, you know, and the whole charismatic Pentecostal. It wouldn't go as far as that, as the Pentecostal side of things. But Nicky Gumbel would be less of a Calvinist type of evangelical than perhaps Jensen is, and maybe St. Helens Bishopsgate is. Of course, there you have the Alpha movement, which is so phenomenally successful all over the world. And if you like it, to many people outside the church, that type of evangelicalism might have more immediate appeal because it seems a little bit softer. But if you get back down to the roots of it, it's just the same. It's some strong stuff.
Ruth Gledhill, fascinating to talk with you. A great insight again. Look forward to talking to you again in a few weeks' time.
Thank you.